Hey, morning, everybody. That was beautiful. Thank you. Those both those songs were kind of personally captivating, and I resonated with for a couple different reasons. Maybe I mentioned this last time you played the Dragonfly song. So the very first kind of solo wilderness fast I did was in Capitol Reef National Park, and I was like 9,000 feet among these Navajo petrified sandstone dunes amidst juniper and just a wild place and baregas. You know what baregas are? Don't look them up on your phone. And I went to immerse myself in this drying desert pool from flash floods. And as I was coming up out of the water, I was like, what are these little creatures? I was like, they look like swimming dragonflies. Is there such a thing? So I didn't know that the dragonfly had a life cycle until I was at 9,000 feet, and I saw it with my own eyes. So, and the other song, yeah, beautifully too. It brought me to a memory. I used to ride horses when I was younger, and I worked at a ranch for a summer. And so yes, I used to be a cowboy. I had a hat and everything, and rode the barrels. And but one day I was coming. It was like kind of morning time, and this is in upstate New York, and I was just walking across the field, and it was sun raining, like you were saying, and just for a second, every single drop of rain had inside of it like a tiny rainbow, like a prism, like billions of them. And that was—I don't think I've ever even told that story or thought of it till that song. So yeah, I think I could hear the music of the foxes too at the same time. So yeah, thank you. Charity, what a beautiful meditation, great way to start us off. My question for today, we're on the series of the great questions, is can we move beyond right-left tribalism? And you might want to think about that in light of Charity's meditation, which is your own life cycle is somewhere in a larger pattern here and of generations. And so how you live and what you're up to and the kinds of things that you promote and matter to multiple generations here. And so can we move beyond right-left tribalism? No. I'll see you next week. yeah, I think it's a question worth wrestling about. So I'm going to take three approaches to it. I'm really trying to start a conversation here. So I want to talk about it. First of all, from the perspective of brain science, I want to talk about the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere and what the heck is going on. And then I want to talk about it from a psychological point of view, which is what about personality? How does personality weigh into and what might we need to know about the most contemporary research around human personality that might inform us when it comes to this question? And then I want to, I'm going to read a little bit. I put part of the section in your bulletin there from this book called The Coddling of the American Mind. It's a very interesting book about what's going on college campuses, and there's a little section in there about tribalism and just a few little hints about why it's so captivating and also maybe ways to wrestle with it more intentionally and not feed it. So anyway, that's the terrain I want to cover today. So, so let's begin by talking about the left and right hemispheres of the brain. So we're going to go back to seventh grade, and when you first probably learned about brain hemispheres, I'm guessing, I have no idea, I can't even remember seventh grade, barely. But that's where I want to start. And a lot of what I'm going to share comes from a book called The Master and His Emissary by Ian McGilchrist. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It will blow you out of the water. Anyway, he's been collecting all this data and research around brain science and how the hemispheres work. So, so first of all, just some very obvious things. The brain is divided into two halves. Now that is weird. Isn't that weird? Like if you were God and you're like, you know what? I'm kind of bored. And I'm going to create some humans, I guess, and you know, I'm getting a little tired of the just talking to the Trinity here or whatever. So need a little more action. So so you decide you're going to create human beings, and then just before, you're like, you know what, I'm just going to divide the brain in half and see what happens. And I'm going to give totally different jobs to each hemisphere just to keep things interesting. It's kind of odd. It's unusual. Unless you start to wonder something like, what is the nature of reality? Like, how does the human brain even, how do the two halves of the hemisphere reflect other things that are in the natural world? What kinds of things are at in tension? And when I get into the specifics of what these hemispheres actually do, it's interesting that these two things are in tension. And they have different perspectives. You probably know this, but you have two people living inside your head. Now, some of you say, I have a whole lot more than that. Okay, granted. But you have two hemispheres. And they have totally different perspectives on what's true and what's real and how to move and operate. And they both serve a purpose, even though if at times that purpose is in conflict. So in other words, they have a kind of paradoxical function. And it's like, I don't know, right in the center of our existence is a kind of living paradox. You are a living paradox. And perhaps that's also just called life. We move through life through a series of living paradoxes, I suppose. So, okay, what is the left hemisphere? The left hemisphere, if you can remember, is about explicit knowledge, and it's concerned with what it knows. Or we can put in parentheses what it thinks it knows. It's the part of it that says, I know what I'm talking about. And it's much more objective. We would even say, you might want to use words like rational, but we'll put that in quotation marks, because you'll see why in a minute. It's the part of us that can abstract, like pull things out, make abstract statements or claims about things. Now, if you think about it from an evolutionary point of view, is this needed? Yes. It's the reason why you're here, why Homo sapiens have survived the many millions of years of evolution. It was not a guarantee, you could say. Okay, it also recognizes parts. So the left hemisphere of the brain recognizes parts. It likes to divide, in other words. This part, this part, this part, this part, that sort of thing. And it also likes to deconstruct, which is virtually the same thing. Recognizing parts gives us the capacity to pull things apart and deconstruct. Which you could also, you know, inversely say, it can also help us construct things. If you can see the parts, you can rearrange them. And now, these are all necessary and needed. Guess what? I'm not going to say the left brain is better than the right brain, and we're all going to get, I'm left brain only t-shirts, you know. And no. It doesn't work that way, you'll see, but it has its place in human life. Okay, it also is the part of us that controls language and speech. Pretty necessary. What I'm doing right now is a left brain activity. And part of what's happening in you as you're listening to me is your left brain is computing the parts of speech and recognizing it and understanding it, at least to a certain degree. It's the part of us that is involved in explicit communication, being very clear about what we're saying, okay? Explicit communication. It's also able to theorize, and I already said this a little bit, and it likes to see the parts of things. In other words, it doesn't tend to see the whole, just the parts, okay? That is the left hemisphere. And if that gets damaged, and it can be damaged in a variety of ways, you can see the problems that it's going to create. You're not going to be able to do these things. And it's not because, you know, of some, you know, psychological defect. No, it would be a brain defect. You would be unable to communicate in these various ways. You'd be unable to see the parts of things. You'd be unable to understand what I'm talking about right now. Okay, that's the left hemisphere. The right hemisphere is much more interested in implicit knowledge, we could say. And it's also concerned with what it experiences. Like we're listening to music here, you're having a certain kind of experience. Well, the right brain is firing up here, and it's saying, ooh, what kind of experience is this? What kind of experience am I actually having? And I'll just go ahead and give you, this is part of what Ian McGilchrist says in his book, it's also, and definitely it's true, we live in a much more left-brain society, all the things that I just read. We tend to prize and highlight that and emphasize that. And even education is built around. If you've seen the move towards STEM education as the real education, that's the left brain saying, we're the best, okay? And we got to get away. We got to get to real concrete things, STEM, got to see the parts, all that sort of stuff, okay? So anyway, the right hemisphere is concerned about experiences. Now, I'm going to say something that's going to sound a little bit sexist, but you're probably going to agree with me. Now, I work with a lot of people in wilderness settings, guiding, and also doing one-on-one work. And this happens more regularly than you would think. So if I'm working usually with a man, and I'll say, well, how did that make you feel? Classic question you might have heard from your therapist. How'd you make that feel? More often than not, I will be told what they think. And so I'll ask again, well, how'd that make you feel? And they'll say again what they think. What hemisphere is operating? It's the left hemisphere. And sometimes I'll have to keep asking it until they can hear what I'm saying. I'm asking you how you feel. And you know what they often say at that point? I don't know how I feel. And I think, okay, now we've begun. Because now we can explore that. Okay? So that's the right hemisphere. It's much more into experience. Okay. It appreciates context, the right hemisphere appreciates context. It understands, this is probably the most important thing, the relationship between things. So not just parts, but relationships. How are things related? What are patterns of relationships? What are the energies of relationships that are present in a particular place? Like someone who is very left brain, if they were giving a talk right now, they would not be even aware of how things are happening in the room relationally and where the patterns of energy are. But a person who has a little more access to the right brain or has flexed that muscle would be giving a talk but also paying attention to is it working? You know, it wouldn't just be about the content. It would be about the relational dynamics that are at work. Am I making sense what I'm saying? Okay. The right hemisphere is responsible for meaning. This is why scientists will say things like, we're just telling you the facts. We don't care what it means. That's not our domain, all right? Well, that's the domain of the right brain. It's concerned about meaning. It's also the part of us, I think this is interesting, that recognizes faces. Now, human beings have evolved, and the human eye is a very important part of our evolution and affected how we evolved. What many evolutionary biologists say, our capacity to recognize faces and read emotional cues is what has really helped us evolve. I can end the sentence there. Okay. It recognizes faces. It recognizes living things, not just individual parts. I don't know if you've ever stood by a tree or even a mountain and there was a sense of, this thing is alive. Now, what part of us is processing the world that way, the right hemisphere, okay? What else? It's the part of us that processes pain. Because it's not just that we feel pain, but what part of us processes that pain? And also the capacity to process pain that we sense in other people. That's a right brain deal. And when that's not functioning well, there's a lack of empathy. That's the conclusion. When there's the right brain, if it doesn't function at all, there's no empathy. But if it's not functioning well or it's not well activated or something like that, you're not able to process the pain of someone else. You're cut off from it in some way. Maybe a few other things. Emotional understanding, that's kind of another way of talking about empathy. Implicit communication is a part of us that can understand implicit communication. Like when someone says on the phone, well, it's been good talking to you. Okay, implicit communication is, I'd like to get off the phone. Okay, but if you're not well aware of that, you'd be like, well, it's good talking to you too, and you might just continue on with your sentence. All right, some people, they really suck at implicit communication. All right. Interestingly enough, it's the part of us that where instinct is housed, certain kinds of instincts, and it mediates social behavior. That's very important. It mediates social behavior. See, a left brain, which might be much more into the rigid rules, well, the right brain can mediate between things. So saying, okay, this and this. It's a little complex. Well, what is that capacity to mediate? That's the right brain. Okay, and most importantly, it sees the whole. It sees the whole. It's much more interested in this larger, holistic vision of what's true and what's real. And it's emotionally receptive to music. All right? That's why you get the chills listening to things. That's not the left brain's like, I don't know what's going on. The right brain is like, finally. Okay? In other words, it houses our capacity to feel and understand and experience beauty. All right, that's the right brain. Okay, so now, Ian McGilchrist talks about this study in here by a guy named Raman Chandran. And it's a very famous study, and it has to do with those who suffered brain damage and a severance between the right and left hemispheres, which can happen a variety of ways. Head trauma, it can happen because of stroke, it can happen because of surgery to help someone survive. So he did a series of studies where there was no communication between the left and the right brain, just to try to gather some facts. And this is good stuff right here. Okay, so those who had experienced right hemisphere paralysis, okay, so the right hemisphere, everything I just went through is not working anymore. There's paralysis there. And he would say, which also corresponds to physical limitations, but I don't want to get into all that now, but you'll see what I mean. So he would tell the people, he would take a person and say, I want you to, with your left hand, which doesn't work, okay, if you have right hand, complete right hemisphere paralysis, I want you to point with your left hand at my nose. Okay. Now, right away, you can say, this sounds like a cruel experiment. But here's what would happen. He would ask them, are you pointing now? And they would say, yes, I'm pointing now. Okay? When very obviously they can't point, but they think they're pointing. So what is happening? So he started to wonder something like, can the left brain, when it's the only thing operating, construct delusions? And it can. If it thinks something should be the case, it's the case, regardless of whether it's true or not. All right? So let's just translate. If you're little too left brain, you're likely to think something is true and believe it's true, even if it's 100% false. Okay? Yes. Huh. Now, in case you're thinking, oh, he's talking about the Republican Party. No, I'm not talking about, I'm talking about you, all right? I'm talking about everyone has this. And if the right hemisphere is completely inoperative, you're likely to believe delusions. Now, this experiment gets even weirder. So not only was this true across the board with people with total right hemisphere paralysis, he would put people in a room together who all suffered from it and then ask them, say, is that person over there pointing at my nose? And you know what all of them said? Yes. So collectively, they'll get on board with the delusion, we would call it, because they think it should be true. This person should be able to point at their nose, and therefore they must be, and they would all agree they're pointing at that. Now, in case you think they're lying, what I'm telling you is they're not making it up. They believe this to be the case. Now, you have to go ahead and stop at this point and say, the brain is weird. Wouldn't you agree? So this little example is saying something like, when we're too left brain, which is definitely modern Western culture, definitely, some things can go awry. Okay? Now, there are ways to exercise and open up the right brain. I'm not going to get into all that. I'll give you one hint. Maybe I'll just get into my solutions, because one of the most surprising things in McGilchrist's book here, and he's got a new one called The Matter with Things. It also costs $137. It's in two volumes, so I haven't bought it yet. Okay, I'm going to give you a quote here. Beauty, morality, and truth, all of those, by the way, are right hemisphere things, especially truth, big picture, holistic truth. Morality, remember what I said about mediating between things, okay? And beauty, all right hemisphere, he says, in our culture, beauty, morality, and truth have been downgraded, dismissed, or denied. If you want to see the consequences, you need do no more than look around you. All right, That's his sort of assessment of contemporary culture right now. So, solution number one to can we get beyond left-right tribalism is beauty. That's what I'd like to suggest. Exercising beauty. Pursuing beauty. Pursuing art. It helps open up the side of us that mediates between things and is less tribalistic. Yesterday I went to a concert, all right? I went to a concert outdoors. I didn't know what people believed unless I had a very obvious t-shirt on, you know? But the music, sitting there listening to music, I wasn't going around and saying, is it safe to sit by you? Can you give me your political opinions? Do you have a concealed weapon permit? You know, I wasn't dividing the world up like that. We were all enjoying something together. The experience of beauty helps lessen those capacities in us which are needed and necessary, they're not wrong, to divide between parts, deconstruction, us versus them, all the things that the left brain is very good at. Am I making sense? Now, I know I sound like a hippie for a moment, that beauty can save the world, but I'm telling you, that's what the brain science says. And we shouldn't underestimate it. And when we don't invest as a culture in things that are beautiful, we're in real trouble. If everything is just utilitarian and disposable consumer crap, you know, we're deprived. We're deprived of beautiful things. We're deprived of beautiful music. Everything we're suspicious of, they want to sell us something, you know? So it's like, this is not faring very well. Cultures that invested in beauty were rich, so to speak, but not necessarily materially, but enriched lives. And the brain science is saying, believe it or not, this helps lessen tribalism. It helps lessen the dominance of left brain thinking. Have I made sense? Solution number one, make something beautiful. Make your house beautiful. Make one room beautiful. Make your garden beautiful. You want to go the next step? Make a public space beautiful. The other day I was biking and there was like a stretch of land downtown somewhere or whatever, and the community had put up like these massive community gardens and it looked beautiful. And I thought, this is good. You know, when I lived in Heritage Hill downtown, all the neighbors got together because there was this big parking lot that was just gross. Now it served some purpose. That's where I taught my kids how to ride a bike, you know, but I could do that somewhere else. But as soon as the community pooled their own money and convinced the city to pitch in something and made a park, the whole neighborhood was transformed. And that helps the right brain that it can finally breathe again. And you're less likely to be suspicious of your neighbors when you're not living next to a gross, nasty parking lot. Believe it or not. All right? Okay, so that was point number one. Okay, I'll make the other point shorter. Point number two. Let's talk about the Big Five personality test. All right, Big Five personality. So now we're going to shift from brain science to personality. So I don't need to go through the whole thing. I mentioned little bits and pieces about it before. It's the most contemporary sort of universal personality test. It's a little like the Myers-Briggs, but it's pared down a bit, and I think it's more useful in some ways. Okay, here are the Big Five. And when you take the Big Five, which you can go online, you can do it for free. I mean, there are better versions and worse versions, but you would get the basic sense for it if you did it. You get a number. So each of the words I'm going to mention, you're somewhere on a scale. All right. So here are the Big Five. Openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, my personal favorite, okay? So the Big Five, yeah, so you get a score. Everybody is all of these things, but to various degrees, all right? And the combination of those things more or less make up your personality. And your personality can change. Like over time, you might score higher or lower on things based on experience or whatever, things that happen to you or just basic growing up, who knows? So the things I want to focus on right now, I'll do some defining of the terms. Openness is not exactly what it sounds like. Like, well, I'm just open to all religions, okay? It's much more about how you're processing reality. Like, if someone comes into your space, like, let's say you've been renting a space for a long time, and another group comes in and decides to rent the neighboring space, just imagine, theoretically, and your immediate reaction is, nope, then you're probably not going to score all that high in openness, believe it or not, okay? And that's part of your personality. That's not a moral defect or anything. It's just partly how you're shaped, your disposition in the world, all right? Conscientiousness, well, is exactly what it sounds like. Do you follow through on things or not? Are you conscientious? So if you stop at a stop sign and like a four-way stop, and even if you were there first, you still insist on the other person going, you're like, oh, go ahead. You're probably more conscientious, all right? Me, I'm just going to go. I mean, it doesn't matter if I was there first or not, or if I even stopped, all right? Extroversion, most people are familiar with this, but what's interesting about it is just a scale of extroversion. It's not, you know, introversion is the corresponding sort of other side of this, but it's just measuring extroversion. And that's also about processing reality much more than, like, I like to go to parties. But anyway, agreeableness is, well, how agreeable are you? Like, let's take the former president of the United States. Guarantee you, he is very low in agreeableness. All right? And a lot of people are. It's not necessarily a moral defect. He's just low in agreeableness. Other people are very high in agreeableness. Like, where do you want to go to eat? I don't know. I was thinking we could get burgers. Well, I was thinking pizza. Oh, yeah, I was thinking that too. That sounds good. It's a very agreeable person. Okay. And the final thing is neuroticism. And that's just, in this case, we can take it to mean how affected you are by negative emotion. That's really what neuroticism is. Everyone has negative emotion, but people who are high in neuroticism carry it much more fervently and longer than people who are low in neuroticism. Like, I'm low in neuroticism most of the time. So if someone criticizes me, it's not going to ruin the rest of my day, really, even. But other people, it can ruin the next 5 years. All right, because they're higher in neuroticism. And I know people say neurotic, but just all I mean is negative emotion here. Okay, so one of the interesting things that's coming out of the research, and I'll be very brief about this, is guess what? If you're relatively high in openness, which I am very high in openness, your political disposition tends to be more liberal. If you're low in openness, it tends to be more conservative. That is a personality thing. And these things are roughly split down the middle. Now, all this time, I thought we were playing a moral superior game, where I have these views, I'm morally superior than you. It turns out that much more of our political persuasions, or disposition is probably the best way to say it, is rooted in personality. Now, you can't go line by line. Like, if you're high in openness, you have this particular political position. It doesn't work like that. It's just a disposition. That's all. Here's another thing. If you're low in openness and you're very high in conscientiousness, you're almost guaranteed to be a conservative because you're very conscientious. You're concerned about tradition and you're concerned about doing things right. And you're low in openness, so you're not that interested in whatever the latest thing is. I'm telling you, that's a personality thing. So I hear this research, and I think I have to rethink the whole right-left thing, period. Brain science makes me want to rethink it. Contemporary psychology makes me want to think it, because I can't say anymore, well, one day we'll all be like me. All right? Well, you wouldn't want that anyway. Or they'll all come over to my side. Guess what? Human beings are going to keep having babies. And if you have children and you've had more than one child, you know that they come out kind of wildly different. Like, in terms of personality. And that's just what's going to keep happening. So part of what we have a responsibility to do toward ending right-left tribalism, to say, some of this is just disposition. And so what can I learn from someone who has a different disposition? Can I not learn from anyone who's not as open as me? I happen to be massively high in openness and so embarrassingly low in conscientiousness that I don't want to tell you the number, okay? But I have something to learn from someone who's conscientious. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it should change the way we talk about the right-left divide right now. Some people are, we would say, wired. I don't like computer metaphors for human beings, but I guess it works for the time being. Some people are wired in a certain way, and I think we have some responsibility to honor that and then talk about the values of that. All right, it's a value to be low in openness. In what sense? It's a value to be high in openness. Well, in what sense? And same with all of these things. Do you see how they don't have a scale of good or bad on them? They just are. And then the combination of those things makes life interesting. Okay. Just remind you. Okay, I'm not going to remind you of anything. All right, the next one, I want to talk about what I'm going to call tribalism. Now, tribalism is the result of human evolution, as all these things are, including the brain, including psychology, the way I'm using the big five here, but also just groups in general. We are social animals. You know this. You learn this in school. We're social animals. Even if you're an extreme introvert and you want people to leave you alone, you're still doing that in relation to the social sphere. You're a social animal. You're reading reality based on the social situation. We'll never get out of it. So here's something true about evolution over time. We banded together in tribes, and some tribes were more successful than others. Every single one of you in this room comes from a long lineage of successful tribes. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. Now, you can say, well, I'm not into tribalism, but you're here because of it. Your tribe was more successful than other tribes. Now, successful, what do I mean by that? Staying alive. That's what I mean right now. And if you go way back in time, there were all kinds of other Homo erectus beings that also lived for hundreds of thousands of years. And where are they? They weren't as successful in terms of tribalism. So tribalism is part of the reason why we're here. We band together. There's a collective field. You could even say, and I would argue, that you would need different kinds of dispositions and perspectives to band together to get something done. Wouldn't you agree with that? Yeah, and that's part of our evolutionary history. Now I want to read to you this section that's in your bulletin. So let's read it together here. This is from The Coddling of the American Mind. This is kind of an aside in the book. It's really about what's going on college campuses. But, okay, the bottom line is that the human mind is prepared for tribalism. Okay. Through evolution here, we're prepared for tribalism. Human evolution is not just the story of individuals competing with other individuals within each group, although sometimes we think it is. That's not really just the story. It's also the story of groups competing with other groups, sometimes violently. We are all descended from people who belong to groups that were consistently better at winning that competition. Now, I want to pause here for a moment. If you've ever been to, like, a grandkids' t-ball game and they won, you felt good, all right? You're like, yeah, we beat those other kindergartners. Seriously, you cannot help it. I would say there's something wrong with you if you don't feel that, you know? You want your grandkid to win, you know, hit the ball and get it over the fence. Amazing, all right? That comes from evolution, all right? It's part of the reason why you're here. All right, let's keep reading. When the tribe switch, these are in quotation marks, is activated, we bind ourselves more tightly to the group. So, especially in times of fear, anxiety, that switch gets activated and we're like, who's my group? COVID is a great example. Where's the safe group? It depends on your persuasions here, all right? We embrace and defend the group's moral matrix. This is what makes it start to be interesting. Not only do you band together, but you start defending, we're right. Our morality is right. Our moral matrix is the correct one. We stop thinking for ourselves. A basic principle of moral psychology is that, quote, morality binds and blinds. What a line, right? It binds, yeah, and it also blinds, all right? Which is a useful trick for a group gearing up for battle between us versus them. In tribal mode, we seem to go blind to arguments and information that challenge our team's narrative. Merging with the group in this way is deeply pleasurable. As you can see from the pseudo-tribal antics that accompany college football games. go blue, or go green, or go Notre Dame. And then you can put God in there. Not only are we better, but God's on our side, all right? So, yeah, why are we attracted? Why is it pleasurable? Someday I want to go to Manchester United, to their home stadium, and I promise you, I'll paint my face, paint my chest, I will wear a scarf, I will drink beer, I will chant songs, and it will be deeply pleasurable, all right? And if we win, it will be glorious, all right? And if I see people in the parking lot from the other team, I'll gladly give them the finger, all right? Why not? Why not? Okay. Now, this is the section I didn't want to, I didn't put in there because I didn't want the bulletin to be too long, but here's where they start going with this line of thinking. I'm going to read. But being prepared for tribalism doesn't mean we have to live in tribal ways. Just because we're prepared for it, and it's there, it's in our DNA, and it's in our biology, it's in our psychology, it's there, doesn't mean we have to live in these ways. The human mind contains many evolved cognitive tools. We don't use all of them all the time. We draw on our toolbox as needed. Local conditions can turn up the tribalism or turn it down. Isn't that true? And if you think national conditions can turn up or turn down tribalism, mainstream media, their full-time job is to turn up tribalism. Really? Okay? Any kind of intergroup conflict, real or perceived, immediately turns tribalism up, making people highly attentive to signs that reveal which team another person is on. I want to know which team you're on. I want to know which team you're on. Become hyper-vigilant in a way. Traitors are punished, and fraternizing with the enemy is too. Conditions of peace and prosperity, in contrast, generally turn down the tribalism. All right? People don't need to track group membership as vigilantly in times of peace and prosperity or when that's being promoted. When a community succeeds in turning down everyone's tribal circuits, there is more room for individuals to construct lives of their own choosing. Isn't that fascinating? So you can construct a life of your own choosing by turning down some of those mechanisms of tribalism. Otherwise, you're then captivated by group energy and the self, the individual, is lost somewhere in there. Now, because this book is largely about college campuses and their effect on the world right now, let me read just a little teaser for the book. So what happens to a community such as a college or increasingly a high school when distinctions between groups are not trivial and arbitrary, but when they are emphasized rather than downplayed? What happens when you train students to see others and themselves as members of distinct groups defined by race, gender, and other socially significant factors, and you tell them that those groups are eternally engaged in a zero-sum conflict over status and resources? He says, that's the college campus. That's what they argue for. Now, you should read the book to find out what they're talking about. But that's interesting. That's turning up the tribalism. So what's my concluding point here? What solutions are present? Because part of the answer to the question, can we move beyond right-left tribalism, is actually no. It will be ever present. It's in our biology. So the better question is, what can we do about it? And I'm suggesting beauty. I'm saying rethink personality, get to know your own personality, and get to know the way we function psychologically. It might change the way you treat your neighbors if you start to understand that there are some personality differences here and there's some value here. Okay? And the third is really a question that maybe is coming up out of Charity's image of the butterflies flying somewhere. What are we doing right now to turn down tribalism by our own rhetoric and promoting what they call peace and prosperity? When you work toward basic things like peace, prosperity, well-being for yourself and others, that knob starts to go down. But what we think in times of anxiety and there's tension between groups is our immediate reaction is to crank up the dial. saying, I see what it is. Let's go toward us versus them, and then we're going to be victorious. You know? But, like, let's take what happened with Trump and Biden. Trump lost, okay, the election, and Biden won the election. And probably many people thought, well, it's over. Okay, that's over. We won. Or the other side would say, we lost. Well, guess what? Next year, there's going to be another round of this whole thing that we call voting, all right? And what's happening is that every time we're faced with conflict, you and I, or are the institutions that we're a part of, or groups that we're a part of, are looking for ways to crank that dial of tribalism up. And guess what that's going to lead to? More tribalism. And guess that's what's going to lead to, according to evolutionary biology here, and tribalism, that leads to violence. That's where it goes. And we don't need more of that. So I think you can ask yourself, what am I doing to turn tribalism down? I think, and you can do so with your rhetoric. That doesn't mean that you can't have an opinion about things. Of course you can have an opinion about things. And you can be interested in promoting well-being and prosperity and peace and a culture and a neighborhood and a garden that is for the benefit of as many people as possible. Have I made some sense? All right, thanks for listening.